María de mi vida.
María of my life.
Solo tengo fe en las dos cosas que amo. Tú y la revolución.
I have faith only in the two things that I love. You and the revolución.
Sí, María. Fuera de ti y la revolución, nada hay para mí ni nada quiero.
Yes, María. Outside of you and the revolución, there is nothing for me, nor do I want anything.
Pienso solo en ti y en la revolución. De las dos estoy enamorado.
I think only of you and the revolución. I am in love with you both.
What you were just hearing is a letter written by Mexican revolutionary Ricardo Flores Magón, adapted for the stage by a television station in California. The letter was written in Los Angeles just before Magón began a 21-year sentence at the federal penitentiary in Leavenworth, Kansas. New research suggests that in the early 20th century, Leavenworth was practically a university of radicalism on an international scale, with Magón serving as one of the distinguished inmate professors. In fact, back in the day, it was home to a unique mix of soldiers, war dissenters, radical labor organizers, foreign-born radicals, black militants, and Mexican revolutionaries. Who knew? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear that story in all its incredible detail. Christina Heatherton is with us from Trinity College in Connecticut. She's the researcher who uncovered this little-known piece of Kansas history. Hi, Christina.
Hi, good morning, Gina.
Good morning to you, too. How did you end up researching radicalism at Leavenworth Prison? That's an obscure topic to land on.
Well, first of all, I got to say it's incredible to me that anybody in Kansas City is thinking about anything but the World Series. And it floors me that we're going to talk about the Mexican Revolution today.
Well, yeah, we've got to move on, even though we maybe don't even want to.
The Mexican Revolution is something that I've been studying for a book I'm writing called The Color Line and the Class Struggle, The Mexican Revolution, Internationalism, and the American Century. And I, frankly, was as surprised as you that there was such an interesting chapter that occurred in Kansas, and particularly, as you said, in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, where the great leader of the Mexican Revolution, Ricardo Flores Magón, died, or as many argued, was killed.
Well, so can you explain to me a little bit more about your personal journey that led you to picking up on hints that there was something really interesting happening in Kansas as related to the Mexican Revolution?
Well, the story found me rather than I found the story. And I think the best hidden histories happen this way. Of course, I was interested in Leavenworth because this is where Ricardo Flores Magón's life ended. But in the process of doing just kind of external research to his story and trying to understand, for example, the relationship Mexican revolutionaries had to the industrial workers of the world, to people who were organizing in the United States, to communists, socialists, pacifists, the name Leavenworth kept coming up again and again and again. It really was one of these stories where all roads led to Leavenworth. So by the time I got to the National Archives, which are in Kansas City, the Central Plains Region chapter of the National Archives, and I started looking through all the prisoner records, it was extraordinary to me that all these prisoners were in Leavenworth at the same time. And not only were they there at the same time, they were talking to each other. They were organizing with each other, as I'm sure we'll talk about. They had a night school. There were parades. There were newspapers. It was an extraordinary hubbub of activity. And as you said, one federal surveillance file, who was also looking into this, called Leavenworth at this time during World War I a university of radicalism.
What did you see that really told you this? I mean, take us with you to those archives. What are you uncovering?
Boy. First of all, I knew that people were in there at the same time.
When are we talking about?
Sure. I mean, I'm particularly looking at Leavenworth during the period of 1917 to 1922 about. And the reason why this is so significant is this is the advent of a whole slew of new federal legislation. So, you know, let's go back in time and just remember that this is where the U.S. is in World War One. There's a whole new series of laws that have been passed. There's the Espionage Act of 1917 that makes it a felony to make any false statements which might, that's the operative word, which might cause insubordination or disloyalty in the military. There's the Selective Service Act. There's the Sedition Act. You know, and all these things are, you know, very nebulous, abstract, broadly deployed against anybody who in any way is showing disloyalty to the U.S. government during World War One. And so, of course, the people being ensnared are people who are organizing, you know, for a number of different causes across the United States. You have a number of people from the Industrial Workers of the World, you know, a group more popularly called the Wobblies, that were organizing explicitly against the war. And they were ensnared by this act. There were Mexican revolutionaries like Magón and his comrade Librado Rivera who were also ensnared by this act. And they're thinking about U.S. imperialism in a broader way. There are socialists and communists. There are also pacifist Mennonite people. And there's also a number of military prisoners who are sent to Leavenworth for their disloyalty in the military. So, I mean, what's interesting about this period is you have this dramatically new surveillance and security infrastructure that's making these crimes of disloyalty federal crimes. And so that's why Kansas becomes so important, because all these people from all these different walks of life, all these different countries, labor radicals, you know, nationalists, pacifists, socialists, communists, anarchists, they're all being ensnared by the same set of laws. And, you know, at least here we see one instance where they're all being sent to the same place.
And Ricardo Flores Magón was somehow central to all of this, right?
Ricardo Flores Magón, you know, was central in a number of ways. I mean, he both had been a longtime organizer, activist, journalist, agitator. He had a huge following. The, you know, the immigration cards in a at the U.S.-Mexico border asked people, you know, like where they were from, you know, where they intended to go, and whether or not they were an anarchist, because the explosion of anarchism, the kind of anarchism that Ricardo Flores Magón and his followers had created was so broad that it actually became a category of surveillance in itself. So he had a huge following inside, you know, outside and inside the penitentiary. And, you know, as you see, you know, according to a lot of the prison records, he was an adored figure, too. He was someone who, you know, was a lecturer himself. He would talk both about the Mexican Revolution as well as about political philosophy. He would write, he would help translate things. He would help prisoners write letters. He worked in the prison library. He was a kind of larger-than-life figure that people had incredible affinity for. When he was incarcerated in McNeil Island, another federal penitentiary, there's this wonderful line where someone wrote, "There was no Mexican worker who was in prison with him who wouldn't put down his shovel and take up his to make sure that he didn't have to do an extra ounce of work." He was just, he was so beloved. You know, as a consequence, the way that other radicals were thinking about the Mexican Revolution, you know, was impacted by this man and other figures of the Mexican Revolution, including his brother, who were incarcerated there at the same time.
Tell me a little bit more about Ricardo Flores Magón's background. He was born in Mexico, but a lot of his agitation against the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz took place here in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's the kind of punchline to the story. And it's one of many reasons why, in order to think about the Mexican Revolution, we have to think about it as a transnational and even an international event. Ricardo Flores Magón was in Mexico. He was organizing and agitating against, as you said, the dictator Porfirio Diaz. And he's also observing and organizing and agitating against the transformation of the Mexican state. A lot of those transformations are happening as a result of American capital. By the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution, there's over a quarter of U.S. capital is invested in Mexico. And so this massive industrial transformation, this massive reshaping of the landscape, so much of this is happening through U.S. companies, U.S. money. And so, you know, it's not just that Ricardo physically crosses the U.S.-Mexico border, but the whole time he's calling attention to the fact that not only is there this dictatorship in Mexico, but a lot of that power is being underwritten by American interests.
How is he drawing attention to that, though? I mean, how is he doing that? What stuff is he doing?
Well, you know, I mean, it's actually not just his observations in particular. He's looking at what the Mexican working class and peasantry are doing at this period. And they're the ones who are organizing massive strikes, massive protests against American copper companies, American railroad companies, American sugar companies, oil companies, all sorts of interests that are in Mexico and... you know, I mean, there's no nice way to say it, that are heavily exploiting the workers there. And people are responding in a variety of different ways. I mean, sometimes, you know, there are stories such as the Cananea Copper Company, where Mexican workers are just outraged because they can see both how little they're getting paid, but they're actually American workers who are working there as well, and their housing's just a little better, and they're being paid just a little more. And so there's just a whole segmentation of, you know, the workers according to their nationality. And so it's the workers at Rio Tinto, at Cananea, who are rebelling against these conditions. Magón is, you know, like a lot of great organizers. He's not telling people what to think. He's articulating a commonly felt demand across the country. And also demonstrating how this is, you know, this is not just a nationalist struggle. This is something that has to be cognizant of the connections to the United States and U.S. capital.
And he's articulating these ideas through publication, right?
I'm sorry, that was probably the direct answer you were looking for. Yes. Magón was an organizer and he was also a journalist. So his most popular publication that he did publish on both sides of the border was called Regeneración, Regeneration. And this was a paper that he and his comrades were publishing, as you said, in a number of different cities, including Los Angeles. And what's so interesting is that these editorials that he's writing are written both to Mexican workers in Mexico, but they're also written to Mexican workers that are in the United States. And, you know, he's also trying to think, workers of the world, you have to understand this struggle. I mean, what's so fascinating about the Mexican Revolution is that this breaks out in 1910. So this is before the Russian Revolution. And Magón is making all these speeches and writing all these editorials saying, everybody in the world, you have to understand that this struggle in Mexico will be the revolutionary struggle that breaks open all the revolutionary energy that will lead the revolution for the entire world. And he's doing this, yes, largely as a journalist.
So how'd he end up in Leavenworth? He was convicted of, you know, going against the Anti-Espionage Act. On what grounds?
Well, he and his comrade, Librado Rivera, wrote an editorial, which was called The Manifesto to the Anarchists of the Entire World and to the Workers in General.
That's a funny title.
It's a great title.
Make
I love
sure we've
titles.
Got all of the bases covered.
And I think I'll just quote a few lines from it, especially because it's such a poignant a commentary he's making. He says, the death of the old society is close and it won't be long in coming. The citizen who only yesterday considered the policeman, his protector and supporter, now looks upon him with a grim gaze. The working man goes on strike, aware that it is no longer important that his action injures the country's interests, since the country is no longer his property, but the property of the rich. So, I mean, obviously the U.S. government was surveilling Magón for a number of his activities, but the fact that he and Librado published this editorial, this was the grounds for their violation of the Espionage Act, which, as I said, was this new federal legislation. So to be convicted under the Espionage Act meant that you had committed a federal crime and you were going to be sent to a federal penitentiary. And so that's, you know, the official story, the official trajectory of how he gets to Leavenworth is related to, you know, this particular editorial and the way that he's whipping up, you know, all of this, what the U.S. government would argue was anti-patriotic sentiment when, you know, as you can
just
tell
on
by the
basis
title.
That wealth owns a country now instead of the people. That, well, is that the idea that's really problematic there?
Yeah, I mean, the argument is that, you know, what's so interesting is Magón is saying that, you know, both in the United States and Mexico, and as he said, for the workers in general, that people don't feel like the country is theirs, that it belongs to them. And they're suspicious of the police in terms of protecting those relations. And, I mean, this is an incredible inference of you know, of a deeply felt, like, latent insubordination that he's saying, you know, it exists in the hearts of workers in the United States and around the world. And if you're the U.S. government in World War I and you're trying to conscript people into the military and have them support your cause, you know, a statement like this saying, like, you know, why protect this country? This country doesn't even belong to you, you know, is an incredible, you know, it's an incredible inference of disloyalty.
So did Magón continue to publish and agitate once he was in Leavenworth? I mean, what do we know about how he spent his time in Leavenworth?
You know, there's a really, you know, what was so fascinating about going to the archives I went to, and besides going to the archives in Kansas City, which are just spectacular, and if you can, you know, if you have any interest, I really encourage you to go spend some time in the archives. But, you know, also going to archives in Mexico City, in Amsterdam, throughout New England, you know, and just gathering a sense of the kind of life world of the prison at this time, you get this extraordinary sense of, you know, what Magón would have been a part of. And so, you know, some things that are important to note are that, you know, as I mentioned, the federal surveillance file called Leavenworth at this period a university of radicalism. And this wasn't hyperbole. The prisoners had actually organized a university inside the prison. I mean, you had people who were, you know, both educated lecturers and, you know, academics on the outside, but you also had people who had been trained on street corners, you know, to organize and to think about the connection between history and theory. And Magón was one of these. There's a great story oh, goodness. I told your producer this is like the most dangerous thing to ask a scholar to just talk about something that she's been studying for a very long time. I'm just worried I could like overwhelm you for 2 hours.
No, no. I mean, we've invited you here because we want to hear this story.
Fantastic. You know, I guess, as I said, there was a university. So, you know, there's a wonderful editorial in the newspaper that the prisoners wrote. Which describe it, and they say, you know, there are 600 men that gather of their own volition to come and hear these lectures, and people, you know, lectured on all sorts of things. There were lectures on theory, there were lectures on history, there were lectures on language, but each of these lectures integrated the history and theory with them. So you had wobblies like Vicente Azuara, who were giving, you know, Spanish lessons, but it's Spanish and revolutionary theory. You had Ricardo's brother, Enrique Flores Magón, who wrote a regular column in the Leavenworth New Era newspaper. This column was called The Mexican Kaleidoscope. And so it was like this wonderful serialized column where he told fictionalized stories of the Mexican Revolution, you know, with an understanding that his audience was his fellow prisoners, who maybe didn't know, you know, the kind of contours of the Mexican Revolution. So there's always like a kind of a white American who's asking all these, you know, Mexican people, but why did this happen? And, you know, like, why are you so angry? And then, you know, he has his characters ventriloquize the kind of history and theory. So, you know, Magón was, you know, this was his life world. People were reading radical magazines. People were, you know, gathering outside in the prison yard. There are wonderful stories about the kind of impromptu lectures and conversations and how the prison yard was divided up. There was even a small section that, fascinatingly, the prisoners called Wall Street. And And this was a popular site where particularly a lot of wobblies would come and kind of hold forth and give these informal lectures and classes.
You know, where are the authorities in all this? I mean, what it's amazing to think about that a prison is this kind of like training ground in free thought, and that nobody has anything to say about that.
Well, I mean, obviously there are two sides of this coin. And on one hand, you do see some really interesting, if not cooperation, then at least, some kind of subtle encouragement. So there's this wonderful story about how the prisoners successfully appealed to the warden of Leavenworth to have a May Day celebration. They said, the radicals said, you know, May Day is as sacred to radicals of all stripes, the anarchists, the communists, the socialists, as any religious holiday. And so we demand to have the sacred May 1st holiday. And the prison lets them have it. And, there's this great stories of the prisoners turning their prison-issued jackets inside out, and there's a red lining on the inside. So everybody's wearing these red jackets. They're singing the Internationale. They're having quotes contests, and they're having a parade through the prison. But there's obviously a darker side of the story, which we can talk about.
Because
this is still a prison.
Yeah, we need to get to that. Christina Heatherton of Trinity College, stay with me through the break. KCUR Central Standard will dive right back into this discussion about Leavenworth's radical past. But big breaking news, University of Missouri System President Tim Wolfe has just resigned. Stay with KCUR for more updates and in-depth analysis on Up to Date at 11. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, and as you just heard, University of Missouri President Tim Wolfe has just resigned, and KCUR's Up to Date will have more on that just around the corner at 11, so stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's guest on KCUR Central Standard wrote a thesis titled University of Radicalism, Ricardo Flores Magón and Leavenworth Penitentiary. Christina Heatherton, welcome back to Central Standard.
Thanks so much.
So, you were just talking about where the authorities were in this whole dynamic of so many radicals with so many different causes all converging in this one prison and really educating one another on their shared, the shared aspects of their causes and kind of continuing to motivate one another in the radicalism that landed them in prison.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that, they're having parades, they're teaching each other, there is some degree of support, it seems like, but that there's also a dark side. Tell me about the dark side.
Well, this is a tricky story to tell because, there's both this extraordinary convergence, as you said, of radical interest and energy. And, it's somewhat of a hidden history. We're really accustomed, particularly in this country, to thinking about radical history, in a divided way. Here's the story of Mexican revolutionaries. Here's the story of anarchism. Here's the story of, according to ethnic, racial, political lines, we do tend to make these discrete struggles. So, I think this is a really extraordinary moment of convergence, and it's worth really thinking about, what that meant in terms of revolutionary theory and how people were understanding the world. At the same time, you can't lose sight of the fact that this convergence space was a federal prison, was a federal penitentiary. This was, obviously the warden didn't get out of the way and said, okay, do as you will with this space and educate and, agitate among each other. This was an incredibly repressive environment. And so despite the fact that these contradictions occurred, people were still being sent to what we understand now as solitary confinement. So you have a lot of stories of workers trying to organize work stoppages. You have incredible stories of violence, of people being beaten, of their mail being confiscated. In Ricardo Flores Magón's case, of their medicine being withheld. And this is, continues to be a really untold story of torture in prison in relationship to health care. There's one story I tell just to kind of illustrate the breadth and, what was so harrowing about the punishment, the political punishment of these radicals in prison. And it's around two Mennonite men who were pacifists, who refused, their conscription in the military and were sent to Leavenworth. And, you know, there were a lot of people, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a member of the Wobblies, who described the torture of these men. They were, you know, meant to sleep on the cold ground without any blankets at night. And I know you all in Kansas City with the winter coming, you know what that cold means. And during the day, they were manacled, with their arms above their heads, that their toes barely touched the ground. And they were kept in these stress positions for hours until their, you know, arms would crack and bleed under the pressure. And, you know, some men actually died as a result of this torture. And the kind of final insult to injury was that their bodies were sent back to the South Dakota community they had come from with their corpses dressed in the military uniform that the men had refused to wear in life. And it's one story among many. You know, I mean, there's an article that could be written that's just about the kind of punishment and torture and the harrowing conditions of the penitentiary. And you know, that's not the article I'm writing here. But you know, we do, as you say, have to keep both things in mind. There's both this extraordinary contradiction within the prison that's happening with all these radicals educating each other. But we can't lose sight of the fact that this was a federal penitentiary and it was a very violent and repressive place.
As these people are all coming together and educating each other, sometimes with dire circumstances in their immediate prison surroundings, what resulted from all of this? I mean, are there moments in history that arguably might not have happened if not for this hotbed of radical training in Kansas and in Leavenworth Penitentiary?
You know, there's some wonderful examples of the way in which this convergence space influenced people's thinking. So, for example, you know, you have a letter that 52 of the imprisoned Wobblies write to President Harding in 1922. And, you know, in the process of explaining their plight and explaining their struggle against the war, against the government, they make this stunning comment where they say, you know, the IWW in the press is like the Mexican in the movie. He's always villainized. And I thought, what an extraordinary way to articulate that power relation.
And remind us what year this is again, because that seems like really forward thinking.
Isn't it? Really forward thinking. That's 1922 they're writing that. And, you know, that's one example of many of ways in which people are, you know, and particularly people who are coming out of the prison are thinking, are reflecting on the Mexican Revolution, but also all these different struggles in their writings, in their agitating. I mean, there are, there are people like Ben Fletcher, who is one of the most talented Black Wobblies, who actually had extraordinary federal surveillance, was under federal surveillance, and his mail was gone through. But he was such a powerful organizer, and you know, as a result of people who met him in prison, you know, they would go out and you know, have their grievances transformed into organizable demands. And, you know, people would, I mean, this is the federal surveillance file called it a university of radicalism, because people would go into Leavenworth and they would come out as organizers and agitators, which are with a really unique view of the world. A big part of the story, too, is that, like, as much as this is a story of, self-avowed radicals coming in and sort of, you know, there's this conflictual but interesting meeting of the mind, this is also, you know, a place where military prisoners are being sent. And these are mostly working class people. These are people who are not always self-avowed radicals. They are definitely influenced and inspired by some of these ideas, you know, in the same way that, you know, every kid on every college campus might not be a part of Black Lives Matter or Occupy Wall Street, but they're aware of those ideas. You know, they might be somewhat swayed even if they haven't acted upon them. And there's this whole interesting story, you know, not just about what the radicals did with this unique space, but how this convergence space transformed everybody in it, including the people who, frankly, didn't want to get involved before they got in.
You know, I mean, you've mentioned a variety of different people, Mexican revolutionaries, Mennonite war dissenters. Did all these people kind of band together, sharing their common sense of radicalism, or were there tensions between different ethnic and national groups, even different causes?
Sure. I mean, you know, as I was saying, this really plays out in some important and tragic ways, particularly among the kind of working class soldiers who are, you know, under this incredible sway, who are being trained in this university of radicalism. And one of the most extraordinary finds, you know, stories that I discovered in the archive, totally by accident, was a story of two different prisoners, Roy Tyler and Jose Martinez. You know, Roy Tyler was a black prisoner. He had been a part of the Houston Mutiny. This was this story of, in 1917, a regiment of black soldiers mutinied. They believed that they were, it's a long story, they believed they were under attack. They believed that some white soldiers had killed a black soldier and, you know, against the threat of lynching and, you know, disciplining.
Wow.
They mutinied. Several were hung, but 40 of these soldiers, including this man, Roy Tyler, were sent to Leavenworth. And, you know, these aren't people who are necessarily, you know, publishing newspapers or organizing in the same way as the Wobblies, but this is, you know, they're political prisoners as far as I'm concerned, nonetheless. And Roy Tyler has this fascinating story. You know, he essentially discovers that has this great athletic talent while he's in Leavenworth and, you know, is tutored by none other than the great boxer Jack Johnson, who's in Leavenworth at the same time. He's Johnson's sparring partner. Johnson's somewhat of an athletic coach to him. And Tyler, you know, I mean, so it's very interesting to think about, like, how he was making sense of his experience during the Houston Mutiny, his relationship to this, you know, international, you know, not only boxing celebrity, but this towering intellectual radical, Jack Johnson, and how he's making sense of these questions of race and empire and militarism. And then there's this other story of which is connected, of this Mexican soldier who was also sent to Leavenworth on charges of mutiny, and his name was Jose Martinez. He came from Chihuahua, Mexico, and he joined the military in Texas, and he ends up being this very close confidant of Ricardo Flores Magón, and. You know, the two stories come together in this really tragic way. Jose Martinez actually kills this officer that he believed had tried to kill Ricardo Flores Magón. He killed him in the prison. And it was Roy Tyler who disarmed him. It was Roy Tyler who, you know, took a block of coal, knocked him on the head, and allowed the other prison guards to arrest him, shoot him, and capture him. And I tell this story as a way to say, you know, like, here's this extraordinary world where people are definitely thinking through, as I say, the color line and the class struggle. There's all this potential for interests to converge. But, you know, to get over the things that separate people on the outside of the prison, you know, those separations don't disappear on the inside. And the fact that one man disarms the other, that one man helps the prison guards capture the other man, you know, I think to me this tragic explanation of exactly what you're asking. You know, how did these convergences not always converge?
Yeah.
You know, how were these efforts at organizing around the color line not always successful? There's, you know, it's a long process.
We started this show talking about Ricardo Flores Magón, who was a major agitator in the Mexican Revolution, largely from the United States after he left Mexico. And he was in this prison in Leavenworth, was a major figure there, was admired and loved among people on the inside and out. And he was found dead in his cell in 1922. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, and this is exactly the what motivated Jose Martinez, is the death was so suspicious. Ricardo Flores Magón had been in a lot of prisons in his life for, you know, his organizing and activism. And at the end of his life, his letters to his lawyer are so tragic. He's being denied his medication. He's being misdiagnosed. So, you know, after he passed, Eugene Debs writes in the New York Call that, you know, whether Magón was outright murdered, he suffered slow murder at the hand of the state, because by denying him medication, by not treating his various illnesses, they essentially allowed his death. Now, a lot of historians have said, actually, Magón was killed. The death was so suspicious. Other prisoners saw bruises on his neck. He was moved out of earshot. He had been in a prison cell that was close to his comrade, Librado Rivera. And the night he died, he's moved into another cell. So the death is very suspicious. And prior to his death, he had been beaten by the guard who eventually was killed by José Martínez. And so a lot of historians have taken up the story and said, you know, Martínez watched Ricardo Flores Magón, this larger-than-life leader, be beaten in this prison. And it was, you know, particularly because he was such an influential figure. And Magón is a frail, sickly man at this time. So to watch him be beaten is incredibly traumatizing for the other prisoners. And so what looks like this rash act of violence, this one prisoner attacking this guard, you know, historians of the Mexican Revolution say, no, this man thought he was protecting Ricardo Flores Magón because he understood that they were trying to silence him, you know, ideologically and also physically.
You know, I wonder what you think is the relevance of the story of radicalism at Leavenworth in today's world. I mean, thinking about our own headlines, our own issues, what is it that resonates? What is it that really emerges? Is there some piece of your research that in your day-to-day life, as you think about today's world, pops into your head a lot?
You know, I mean, watching all of the presidential debates right now, I think makes the kind of question brought up by the story of Leavenworth all the more relevant. You see, each one of these presidential candidates in some way fumble on the question of how do you talk about economic inequality, the drastic economic inequality in this country, and also think about the questions being brought up by the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, all you do is see a kind of fumbling, right? Even Bernie Sanders, the great socialist candidate, you know, when asked initially, well, do Black Lives Matter? He fumbles on the question. And I think, you know, this isn't a matter of whether or not each of these candidates have a slick enough line. This is really a matter of how nationally we've been taught to unthink these questions together.
So what do you mean, unthink these questions?
I mean, if we go back 100 years, I mean, the purpose for me of going to the story of Leavenworth Penitentiary is to think about how people were forced to wrestle with these questions of the color line and the class struggle. How were people identifying the major antagonism in the country? Was it around an axis of class? Was it around an axis of race? Could it be both? How did one inform the other? And, you know, so it's extraordinary to see at the beginning of the century, this was such a hot topic of debate. And yet at the, you know, a century later, there's such fumbling around these questions that people can feel come together in different ways, but we have such difficulty articulating. So I'm really influenced, actually, by two University of Kansas professors, Elizabeth Esch and Dave Roediger, who write about the production of difference, who say, look, you know, we kind of have this misnomer in the way that we understand the global economy. People say, you know, it's all about producing sameness, homogeneity. You can buy the same Big Mac in Nebraska that you can buy in Vietnam, that you can buy in Guinea-Bissau, right? And so this is all about creating sameness, homogeneity in terms of our desires. And they say, no, actually capitalism is reproduced through difference, through a concrete reproduction of difference. And another way to say this is what the great geographer Ruth Wilson Gilmore says, is that capitalism requires inequality and racism enshrines it. Wow. So when I'm talking about the color line and the class struggle and how these things come together, I absolutely think that these are the questions we have to be asking at this moment, because in all sorts of different ways, we're already asking these questions. We just don't always know how to think about them.
You know, we don't have very long left, but I also wonder if your research has changed how you think about the state of Kansas. I mean, its geography, its cultural significance, even who lives in Kansas and where?
It's put Kansas on my map in a way I could have never anticipated. You know, when I was 7 years old, I went and visited some friends in Kansas, and all I remembered, frankly, was that it was full of a lot of corn. no offense to the people of Kansas. That's a seven-year-old from Los Angeles point of view. And obviously, you know, to try to sort of trace this Midwest radicalism, you know, this heartland radicalism, like, you know, what were the kind of ripple effects, the repercussions of what was, you know, forced together, torn apart, thought together in Leavenworth Penitentiary. I think actually you're right, you know, requires this whole reframing of the heartland in terms of thinking about the radical theory generated from the country. So, you know, Kansas as a site of theoretical production is on my map in a much bigger way. And Kansas as an archival site, you know, is very much on my map and a place I hope to get back to. I mean, my desire is to turn this chapter into a larger social history of Leavenworth Penitentiary. So I hope to be seeing a lot more of Kansas and Kansas City.
Cool. Well, you know, and again, not much time left, but I'm curious if you have any theories on why more of us don't already know these stories.
Well, you know, I'm a professor of American Studies at Trinity College. And what's so stunning to me is how truncated my students, I wouldn't say their thinking, but their dreaming is. You know, I ask them questions about, you know, in your wildest imagination, I was just asking them this the other day, in your wildest imagination, how would, you know, this kind of, and we're talking about different incidents of exploitation, how would it end? How could you imagine things being better? And before they even speak, they say, well, but this is unrealistic. But we have to think pragmatically. And I say, okay, but as your professor, I'm telling you, dream in your wildest dreams. How do you imagine? And I think this is a kind of microcosm of a broader tragedy. You know, how it is that we're so cautious and cynical about even dreaming of political possibilities. And it's why we have to go back and look at the recovered hidden histories of earlier periods where people didn't anticipate that the world was going to unfold in ways that they could already anticipate, that the world was somewhat open. I think we have to recover some of that. I mean, we've obviously gone through a Cold War that's made it very difficult, that's already kind of clamped down on where some of those dreams end. And I think, I mean, at this moment, we have to reopen this history and we have to look at the world in the same way that these radicals did, you know, as if it's not a foregone conclusion.
You know, you mentioned Black Lives Matter, and I'm curious if you think that the racial makeup of the inmates has anything to do with why we don't know these stories.
You know, and this is a kind of, I wouldn't have found this out if I hadn't actually been at the archives. I was looking through all of the prisoners' mugshots, and actually my finger got caught because some of the mugshots were so thick. And I started pulling them out, and I realized that they were thick because there were a number of mugshots being paper clipped together. And the only mugshots that were being clipped together that were so thick, I pulled them all out, and they were all members of the Houston Mutiny. You see this moment as an early moment in the racialization of the penitentiary. And of course, this is the question Black Lives Matter is forcing us to think about. And these dynamics were in place at the beginning of the century, as well as before.
Christina Heatherton, American Studies professor at Trinity College in Connecticut, thanks so much for sharing your knowledge of Leavenworth's radical past.
Thank you so much.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, a few pieces of Catholic history discovered right here in Missouri. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. During his visit to the U.S. in September, Pope Francis offered praise for a guy named Thomas Merton. Merton was one of the most influential Catholic writers of the 20th century. He spent the last 20 years of his life as a Trappist monk in a monastery in Kentucky. After his death, his writings remained in the public sphere, but it seemed like little else was left behind to remember this man who inspired so many. Reporter Emerald O'Brien of station KBIA in Columbia found out how hundreds of Merton's personal items recently reappeared in Missouri.
When Thomas Merton died in 1968, a fellow monk at his monastery named Brother Irenaeus was given just one order: get rid of everything belonging to Thomas Merton.
Get everything. Get his stuff and get it out of here. I don't care what you do with it. Don't tell me what you do with it. Just get it out of here.
The abbot was worried about admirers coming to the monastery to hunt for souvenirs. So that's what Brother Irenaeus did. And for nearly 50 years, it was as though Merton's personal life outside of his writing never existed at all. Until this summer.
I will just say I am spiritual. Is that good?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good answer. I like that.
John Smeltzer is an author who lives in Kirksville. This summer, while working on a book inspired by the writings of Thomas Merton, he was told of a woman living in Kansas City who owned all of Merton's belongings.
So some little old lady somewhere in Missouri has all of Thomas Merton's personal possessions. I have never heard of that. No one's ever heard of that.
So with his acquaintance who knew her, he arranged a meeting. And at the end, he asked her about the rumor. He says there was a little hesitation, but then she brought him to her garage and showed him two large trunks.
She opens them up, and they're just full, just cram-packed with every single thing Thomas Merton owned at the time of his death. Everything, right down to like his toothbrush.
The woman's name is Helen Marie. We're excluding her last name to protect her identity. And the story of how she came to have these things begins in the 1960s. Helen Marie was a nun in Brooklyn, and by this time, Merton's writing was already famous. All the nuns in her abbey were reading him. And one day, Helen Marie decided she'd like to meet the man that she and all her friends admired so much. So she told her abbot.
And he personally reached into his wallet, gave her the money for a round-trip ticket on a Greyhound, and said, just go. Don't write to him. Don't call. Because they might say no. Just show up.
She went in the dead of winter, arriving in Kentucky during a snowstorm. And being a monastery, they couldn't exactly turn away a nun to the cold. So they put her in a cottage, and she waited.
And for the first day, he wouldn't come see her. Second day, he wouldn't come see her. But he started to admire the tenacity of this little nun who, I'm not leaving.
I finally was allowed to see him, and had my first visit with him, and I thought, how am I going to approach this wonderful, famous, you know, mystic with my lack of expertise and knowledge that most people have. But anyway, he was so simple and so wonderful to talk to. I felt totally at ease.
Helen Marie moved to Kentucky, to the abbey just down the road, and Merton became her spiritual mentor. Every Sunday, she'd join him at the monastery for guidance. They were friends. They'd talk and laugh. Sometimes they'd have picnics. And sometimes another monk would join them, Brother Irenaeus. And as every good story goes, Brother Irenaeus and Sister Helen began to fall in love. But nuns and monks can't marry, so they brought their worries to Merton.
He said, you've gotten everything there was to get out of your monastic life. He said, grow in new areas. Grow beyond that. And I never forgot that. And I never expected that coming from him. It was quite the opposite.
Shortly after his death, Helen Marie and Brother Irenaeus left the convent, taking with them Merton's belongings that Irenaeus had been charged with. They married and eventually moved to Kansas City for work. And for 50 years, all of Merton's things stayed hidden in two large trunks under the clutter of Helen Marie's garage. After her husband died in 2009, she didn't know what to do with them. So, like any good former nun, she began to pray.
I felt that I was to share this, not to keep it for myself. And then when John came, I was so happy because I knew it was an answer to prayer.
Helen Marie decided to give John Smeltzer all the belongings that she had been keeping, trusting him to deliver them to the right places. So Smeltzer spent the rest of the summer researching the items and where they came from and who they should go to next.
Yeah, I was really completely in the dark when John made contact with us.
This is where Dr. Paul Pearson comes in. He's the director of the Thomas Merton Center at Bellarmine University in Louisville, Kentucky. Smeltzer made a pilgrimage from Kirksville to Kentucky in late July to show Dr. Pearson pictures of what he had.
And so it all just came together. I mean, it just all, the whole story came together. There was no doubt, and they said, yes, yes, we want the materials.
Smeltzer had clothes, he had letters, he had photographs, he even had underwear. But Merton's things weren't in pristine condition, and not because they hadn't been stored properly.
One of the things I've noticed from looking at these clothes especially is they prove that Merton walked the walk. He lived the poor monk. Here's another one of his denim work shirts. Look at this thing. Paint all over it from working, ripped to pieces, threadbare, stitched here and there where it's ripped.
Okay, so at this point, you might be wondering, how do we know for sure that all of this is real? Some guy in Missouri has a bunch of ripped up shirts. I mean, those could belong to anyone.
Every single piece of clothing of Thomas Merton has this on it at some place. It's a little tag with the number 127. And here's what it is. It's a laundry tag.
All of Merton's clothing at the monastery was marked with this number, 127, scribbled in pen on the collar of his t-shirts, in Sharpie on a patch that had been sewn in. Some of them even had one or two numbers crossed out before Merton's, meaning they were hand-me-downs.
you just see his real embrace of the monastic life and the poverty that was involved with it.
Smeltzer donated most of the items to the Thomas Merton Center in Louisville, but he also has items that he's working to send to places like the Thomas Merton Center for Social Justice in Pittsburgh and Columbia University, where Merton studied. Oh, and one more place.
And this shirt right here that I'm holding, I'm giving to Pope Francis. I've already written to him. I want to give it to the Vatican because I didn't know how much he admired Merton until that speech to Congress.
After 50 years and an extended vacation to Missouri, Merton's finally going home. Or at least his things are.
That was reporter Emerald O'Brien of station KBIA who brought us that story. And just a reminder, during this last hour of programming, University of Missouri System President Tim Wolf has resigned. Stay with KCUR for more updates and in-depth analysis on Up to Date at 11, just coming right up. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that brings us to the end of today's show. If you'd like to listen back, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today, and tomorrow we'll be talking about data showing a U-turn in white flight. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with KCUR for the latest on racial tensions at Mizzou.